Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Democracy Now.
And we're taking good care of our military. We're increasing spending on our nuclear program because we have no choice because of what China is doing, what Russia is doing in particular. And so we have a very big number in for that.
President Trump has unveiled his 2021 budget request proposing massive cuts to Medicaid and food stamps while increasing spending on the border wall, the military, and nuclear weapons. We'll speak to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston. Then we go to New Hampshire, where polls have opened in the nation's first presidential primary.
This turnout tells me why we're going to win here in New Hampshire, why we're going to win the Democratic nomination, and why we are going to defeat the most dangerous president in the modern history of America, Donald Trump.
On Monday night, Senator Bernie Sanders spoke at a massive rally of over 7,500 people in New Hampshire. We'll go to New Hampshire for the latest on today's primary. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Polls have opened in New Hampshire for the first primary of the election season. On Monday night, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders held a massive rally and concert at the University of New Hampshire in Durham, attended by over 7,500 people.
The reason that we are going to win is the American people, no matter what their political views may be, are sick and tired of a president who is a pathological liar, who is running a corrupt administration, who is a bully and a vindictive person, who is a racist, a sexist, a xenophobe, a homophobe, and a religious bigot.
Meanwhile, the campaign of Senator Amy Klobuchar has picked up the endorsements of three major newspapers in New Hampshire as the Minnesota senator hopes for a stronger result after placing fifth in the Iowa caucuses. The campaigns of Senator Sanders and former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg have called for a partial re-canvass in Iowa after a result showed Sanders winning the popular vote, but Buttigieg narrowly edging him out in the delegate count. Meanwhile, audio has leaked of 2020 presidential candidate, former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg, defending the use of stop and frisk in 2015 at the Aspen Institute. We'll have more on New Hampshire later in the broadcast. The death toll from coronavirus has now topped 1,000 with 42,000 confirmed cases. Monday was the deadliest day yet as 108 people succumbed to the disease in mainland China. In the city of Tianjin, thousands of people were ordered to quarantine after an outbreak linked to a shopping mall infected over 30 people. Meanwhile, in newly identified cases in Hong Kong are raising fears the disease could be spread through pipes after two cases were identified in the same apartment building. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is calling on all 74 federal inspectors general to investigate retaliation-based firings of whistleblowers or witnesses who report presidential misconduct. 2 days after his impeachment acquittal last week, Trump fired two key figures from the House impeachment proceedings, the National Security Council's Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman and U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland. Attorney General William Barr confirmed Monday the Justice Department will review information provided by President Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, that he gathered from Ukrainian sources about former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Senator Lindsey Graham first shared the news on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday. The Justice Department charged four Chinese military members over the hacking of credit monitoring agency Equifax Monday. The 2017 breach affected around 147 million Americans whose personal data was stolen, including Social Security numbers, birth dates, and driver's license information. Attorney General William Barr said China was responsible for state-sponsored computer intrusions. The Salvadoran Congress is condemning what they call an attempted coup d'etat after President Nayib Bukele stormed the Legislative Assembly Sunday, accompanied by heavily armed soldiers and police officers. Bukele is demanding lawmakers vote to approve a $109 million loan to equip military and law enforcement personnel. The president addressed his supporters at a rally in El Salvador Sunday.
If those shameless people don't approve the plan of territorial control this week, we'll summon you here again on Sunday to call for God's support, saying, God, you asked me for patience, but those without shame don't want to work for the people.
In the Philippines, four environmental and human rights defenders and a journalist are being detained after they were arrested Friday night in Tacloban City. The one-year-old baby of organizer Marissa Cabalhau was also taken, but has since been released. Police say the activists were arrested for illegally possessing weapons and accused them of belonging to communist groups. Critics warn such attacks on activists are on the rise. Local media is reporting police have hundreds of arrest warrants for other activists. In more news from the Philippines, the government is moving to shut down the country's leading broadcast network, ABS-CBN, in President Duterte's ongoing crackdown on media outlets that are critical of his rule and his deadly so-called drug war. In Ireland, Sinn Féin is attempting to form a coalition with other left-wing parties after a stunning victory in the general election in which the party won the popular vote. The final count of the vote revealed today Sinn Féin took 37 parliamentary seats, putting it just one seat behind centre-right party Fianna Fáil. Sinn Féin, which originally formed as the political wing of the IRA, focused their campaign on social issues, including housing, homelessness, and health care. This is Mary Lou McDonald, president of Sinn Féin.
You know, it's a big statement of change. It is a big statement that this is no longer a two-party system. It's a statement that people want a different type of government and that people have great confidence in us. And I say that with all humility.
Turkish and Syrian forces clashed in northwestern Syria as tensions rise following the killing of five Turkish troops by Syrian forces Monday. Nearly 750,000 people have fled the area since the fighting escalated in December. The UN is warning the ongoing attacks in Idlib province are creating a humanitarian disaster that could lead to famine in the region. The UN is also warning that the massive swarms of locusts devastating crops in a number of East African countries could become the worst infestation the region has seen in decades. Countries that have already been affected or are at risk are Kenya, Somalia, Ethiopia, Uganda, South Sudan, Eritrea, and Djibouti. Experts say higher temperatures and heavier rainfall due to the climate crisis are leading to worse locust swarms. A small swarm can work its way through enough food to feed 35,000 people in a single day. In Canada, 47 people were arrested around the country Monday while protesting in solidarity with Wet'suwet'en land defenders as they are raided by Canadian police. Protesters around Canada blockaded ports, railways, and other sites of transportation. The blockades affected 20,000 rail passengers and prevented 200 freight trains from traveling. Indigenous activists have been in a protracted battle to protect their land from the construction of TransCanada's 400-mile, $4.7 billion coastal gas link pipeline. The Seattle City Council voted Monday to bar some residential evictions during winter months. The Socialist City Council member Kshama Savant sponsored the bill. If enacted, it would prohibit most evictions in the months of December through February, though the initial bill proposed a longer ban period. In Arizona, the contractor hired to build a portion of Trump's U.S.-Mexico border wall has begun destroying a sacred Tonawdom burial site. Monument Hill is partly located within the Roosevelt Reservation west of the border. border town of Lukeville, Arizona. The site was once used for religious ceremonies, and its cultural significance traces back hundreds of years. Since construction of the border wall began at the Arizona border in August, construction crews have also been ripping out saguaros and other protected cactus varieties, as well as pumping scarce water resources. A South Dakota Senate committee has deferred action on House Bill 1057, effectively killing the controversial anti-transgender legislation. The bill would have criminalized doctors for providing transition-related health care to trans youth. The no vote came after a sustained campaign against the bill led by transgender activists and youth. To see our coverage of this story with the ACLU's Chase Strangio and the Oscar-nominated trans director Yancey Ford, go to democracynow.org. Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance says he's considering reopening the investigation into Malcolm X's murder over half a century after the civil rights leader was murdered in 1965. The announcement came just days after the release of a new Netflix documentary titled Who Killed Malcolm X that sheds new light on the case. And Puerto Rico's Financial Control Board has struck a deal with bondholders to shed about $24 billion from its general obligation debt. The deal announced Sunday will cut the island's outstanding general obligation debt from $35 billion to about $11 billion. However, the island would have to pay about $3.8 billion up front. The agreement will still need to be approved by the Puerto Rican legislature. Puerto Rico's Financial Control Board filed for bankruptcy in 2017 to attempt to restructure $129 billion in debt. The board, which is often referred to as La Junta, is an unelected board that runs much of Puerto Rico's economic affairs and has for years been plagued by corruption allegations. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Juan, before we begin with our top story, can you talk about what's happened in Puerto Rico with the issue of the debt?
Yeah, Amy, this is interesting. I'm reading the articles that have come out in the last couple of days about this, and it's being portrayed as a victory for Puerto Rico in lowering its debt. But what I read of the actual details of the plan is quite the opposite. The island, you cannot pay back debt for which you don't have money to pay. So the entire debt of $70 billion has been questionable. And in fact, the control board had offered these bondholders only about 29 to 30% on the dollar. Now they're getting, with this deal, a much better deal from the Financial Control Board. This is actually a victory for some of the bondholders, especially the vulture funds, because the control board had actually said that it believed that at least $6 billion, the most recent debt of Puerto Rico, was actually illegally issued. And that's the money that the vulture funds came in and the hedge funds grabbed in 2012, 2014. Now they're going to get money back. And in fact, Puerto Rico has to not only pay $11 billion over 20 years, but it's got to put up $3.8 billion up front. In other words, as soon as you sign the deal, you got to give the bondholders $3.8 billion in cash. So the vulture funds are now making out with this.
And explain what vulture funds
are. The vulture funds are the ones who came in and swooped up debt at the very end in the last few years when Puerto Rico really was issuing debt that everyone knew it could never pay. And the vulture funds came in, and as the value of the bonds dropped dramatically, they scooped up the debt at very low prices. So I think that similarly to what they did in Argentina and Greece and other countries that went into financial collapse. So it seems to me that this new settlement, and again, it's only a settlement for $35 billion of debt. There's still another $35 billion in bondholders and another $50 billion that's owed to the pension funds that still has to be resolved. This is a win, it seems to me, not only for the bondholders, but specifically for the vulture funds. And the legislature of Puerto Rico still has to vote on this, and we'll see what happens. But those who portray this as a victory for Puerto Rico are not really paying attention to the details of the agreement.
And, of course, we'll continue to cover this in the days to come.
Well, President Trump unveiled his 2021 budget request Monday, proposing massive cuts to Medicaid and food stamps while increasing spending on the military and his border wall. The $4.8 trillion budget would slash Environmental Protection Agency spending by more than a quarter, while allocating $18 billion for Trump's newly established Space Force. Trump is also requesting billions more for nuclear weapons, including a new submarine-launched nuclear warhead. Experts and Democratic lawmakers warn that increasing the nuclear stockpile will increase the likelihood of nuclear war and defy international agreements.
Democrats are expected to reject the budget, which proposes steep cuts to global health programs and eliminating public service loan forgiveness, a program that cancels the student debts of public workers after they've made 10 years of payments. This is the fourth time Trump has tried to end the program. It also cuts $182 billion from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, in part by significantly increasing requirements for Americans receiving food stamps. Congressmember Barbara Lee tweeted Monday, Trump's immoral budget is full of reckless and cruel cuts to health care, education, housing, basic food assistance, and more, all while funneling billions to a xenophobic border wall. Congress must and will reject it, she tweeted. Well, for more, we go to Rochester, New York, where we're joined by journalist David K. Johnston, winner of a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting. David, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the significance of this unprecedented budget with almost $50 billion or so going to nuclear weapons, more nuclear weapons, with the border wall, $2 billion, and these devastating cuts to Medicaid and food stamps?
Amy, if you want endless wars, dirty air, and you think that the poor and hungry in America are getting too good of a deal, this is a budget for you. That's exactly what this budget is about. Donald Trump, in his inaugural address, said he would be the champion of the forgotten man. Everything he did would be about the forgotten man. Well, he forgot about the forgotten man the minute he walked off the dais. In this budget, he proposes not only all this additional money for nuclear weapons and for the border wall, but he wants to cut the Environmental Protection Agency's budget by more than a fourth. He wants to cut the budget of the Army Corps of Engineers by more than a fifth, and that matters because the dike and levee system that was built in the United States, in the heartland of the country, and many of the dams and other facilities that the Army Corps is responsible for is falling apart, and it's proving inadequate because of climate disruption. We've had these massive floods along these dike systems. To cut the budget for that is just nuts, unless you want to, of course, abandon farming in large parts of the center of the United States. But going after food assistance is absolutely displaying what is really going on here. Donald Trump said he was going to drain the swamp. He has turned Washington into a paradise for the Wall Street swamp monsters that he told voters he was going to go after. And it's very clear that his idea of draining the swamp is getting rid of hardworking, serious people who are trying to make America better and replacing them with people who want to mine the economy and extract money from those down below, because lots of billionaires feel they don't have enough money.
And David, I want to ask you about the tax cut proposal of Trump's. We're seeing this movie repeatedly now over the last 50, 60 years of American history. The Reagan administration cut taxes and created massive deficits that then, when Bill Clinton finally came into office, he was immediately hit. You got to do something about the deficit. Then when George W. Bush was in office, he cut the taxes dramatically. And of course, we had the financial meltdown that led to when President Obama came in, having again to deal with this massive deficit. And now we're seeing Trump, the Trump administration, the current Republicans in Congress doing the same thing. Massive cuts, and now he wants to extend certain tax cuts in this proposal. Can you talk about that?
Well, what Trump is proposing to do is provide a little sop to middle-class families by increasing the child tax credit, extending it into the future when it's scheduled to expire. But continuing his fundamental policy, which is massive tax cuts for people at the very top, people with multi-million dollar annual incomes. The top 1 in 1,000 households have incomes of over $2 million a year. And we have people in America like Mike Bloomberg who make multiple billions of annual income. And he's proposing that we can afford all of this because he's projecting what my children refer to as happy-go magic land thinking about the budget. Each year that Trump has been in office, the 3 years he's been in office, economic growth has gone from here to here to here. It is slowing down, but he projects that it's going to go like this, which is just not going to happen. Nobody believes that. But by claiming it'll go like this, here's what he does. He says the federal budget deficit of roughly $1 trillion a year now, and remember, Trump told us he would pay off the federal debt if he got 8 years. By projecting this economic growth that nobody sees happening when it's actually declining, he's able to argue that the federal budget deficits are going to go down. All the projections show they're going to go like this by everybody outside the administration. So as my children said when they were little, happy-go-magic-land thinking.
Let's turn to President Trump speaking Monday about increasing spending on nuclear weapons.
And we're taking good care of our military. We're increasing spending on our nuclear program because we have no choice because of what China is doing, what Russia is doing in particular. And so we have a very big number in for that. Now, at the same time, Russia and China both want to negotiate with us to stop this craziness of spending billions and billions of dollars on nuclear weapons. But the only way, until we have that agreement, the only thing I can do is create by far the strongest nuclear force anywhere in the world, which, as you know, over the last 3 years, we've very much upgraded our nuclear. But we're buying new. We have the super-fast missiles, tremendous number of the super-fast. We call them super-fast.
David K. Johnston.
Trump is just out in space here. I mean, this is like a lot of things Donald says in the 32 years almost that I've known him. You know, he just makes stuff up. And while there are little pieces of truth in there, this is just all nonsense. We have more than enough nuclear capacity to kill everybody on the planet repeatedly. We have more than enough for mutually assured destruction, which, of course, goes by the acronym MAD, because it's meaningful. And this is Trump simply not understanding the world. The man has no real capacity to understand things. You know, he claims to be the world's greatest expert on at least 23 subjects. But as various people in the White House have leaked out, when he's confronted with being asked something, he turns out to know absolutely nothing. By the way, he's very well parodied in a new HBO show called Avenue 5. A takeoff on Trump's claim that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and nothing would happen to him.
Well, speaking of being out in space, he's also promising, as he cuts food to poor children, $18 billion for a new space force.
Yeah. Do we want to militarize space? I mean, this is just an incredibly nutty idea. We have a United States Air Force that is perfectly capable of dealing with our programs along with NASA. Now, if we want to spend more money to go explore the heavens, I personally am in favor of that. I think it would lead to a lot of great scientific research. It has a cost to it, though, and you've got to bear the cost. And what Trump wants to do is a free lunch. He wants to say to the richest people in America, we're going to lower your taxes. We're going to allow big corporations to earn huge taxes, huge profits, and pay no taxes. And then we're going to spend all this additional money on these things which are discretionary. We can choose to do them or not do them. And at the same time, we're going to say to children and families that are going to food pantries and food kitchens constantly, you know, you've got too much. I mean, it's really a remarkable position. And it's very clear the Republican Party policies that Donald Trump is reflecting here boil down to this. The reason the American economy isn't doing better is the rich don't have enough. And the way to get more to the rich is to take it from the poor, the disabled, from children, from the elderly, that is, from those people who have little capacity to fight back.
And David, this whole issue of once again the president attempting to cut this program that provides loan forgiveness for people who do public service after they graduate from college. I mean, the program has had lots of criticism about how difficult it is, even as it exists right now, for folks to qualify. But this whole idea of cutting the ability of people to reduce their student debt if they do government service is the exact opposite of what several of the Democratic candidates, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and others are saying about forgiving student debt and trying to find a way to get young people out from under a lifetime of servitude to their student loans.
Yeah, Juan, I know people who have lots of gray in their hair who are still paying off their student loans. I was lucky enough to go to college when it was free. In today's money, I paid $120 a year in 2020 dollars to go to college back in the 60s. The real debate we need to be having is what level of education do we need to have a stable and prosperous society? If it's only eighth grade education, then let's get rid of high school. If it's college as the norm and graduate school for lots of people, then let's invest in that. Education is an investment in the future of the country. And what Trump is really doing here is not only helping the bankers who he told everyone he was going to rein in and has never done that, but he is also telling us, you know, don't think about the future. Think about right now. What you need is more now. Never mind what's going to happen to your children, your grandchildren, if you're my age. Let's focus on right now. And this is not a policy to make our democracy endure. And of course, I've said many times, Donald Trump doesn't want our democracy to endure. He wants to be King Donald, and he wants his daughter to become Empress Ivanka I.
Well, David K. Johnston, we're going to leave it there for now. But of course, we'll continue to cover this as it goes to Congress. David K. Johnston is the Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter, previously with The New York Times, now founder and editor of DCReport.org. His recent piece is headlined Trump's Ho-Hum Economy in Three Graphs. He teaches at Syracuse University College of Law. His most recent book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. When we come back, we go to New Hampshire, where polls have opened in the nation's first presidential primary. Stay with us.
We've been through it all, though it could be worse. We've been moved around in a state of alert. There's nothing new or sharp about the cutting edge. If they build a wall, let's jump the fence. I'm over this. Cold stairs can never put the fear in me. What we built here is godly. They can't gentrify the heart of kings. Let's just not talk about it. If I make a move, you're coming with me.
What about the love? Coming with me. What about the neighbor? Coming with me. What about the sea? It's coming with me. The people that you came with? Coming with me. What about the love? Coming with me. What about the neighbor? Coming with me. What about the sea? Coming with me. People that you came with?
James by Anderson .Paak. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, polls have opened in New Hampshire for the first primary of the election season. The vote comes 8 days after the still-disputed Iowa caucus, where both Senator Bernie Sanders and former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg claimed victory. Both candidates have asked for a partial recanvass of the results. On Monday night, Sanders of Vermont held a massive rally and concert at the University of New Hampshire in Durham, attended by over 7,000 people.
This turnout tells me why we're going to win here in New Hampshire, why we're going to win the Democratic nomination, and why we are going to defeat the most dangerous president in the modern history of America, Donald Trump. And the reason that we are going to win is the American people, no matter what their political views may be, are sick and tired of a president who is a pathological liar, who is running a corrupt administration, who is a bully and a vindictive person, who is a racist, a sexist, a xenophobe, a homophobe, and a religious bigot. And those are his nice qualities.
President Trump also held a major rally in Manchester at Southern New Hampshire University Monday. The crowd was estimated around 11,000 people. Meanwhile, Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota campaigned in Nashua. In recent days, she's picked up the endorsements of three significant newspapers in New Hampshire.
If you are struggling to pay for that child care for your kids and choose between that and the long-term care for your parents, I know you and I will fight for you. And if you are struggling to decide between filling your refrigerator and filling that prescription drug, I know you and I will fight for you. That is that sacred trust in this country.
Senator Elizabeth Warren campaigned in Portsmouth, New Hampshire on Monday.
Our democracy hangs in the balance. So it comes to you, New Hampshire, to decide. When there's this much fear, when there's this much on the line, do we crouch down? Do we cower? Do we back up? Or do we fight back? Me, I'm fighting back.
To talk about today's primary in New Hampshire, we're joined by three guests. Arnie Arneson is with us, longtime radio and TV host in New Hampshire. She's the host of The Attitude on WNHN-FM in Concord, New Hampshire, former New Hampshire legislator and Democratic gubernatorial candidate in the 1992 elections in Manchester, New Hampshire, right now, as is Norm Solomon, co-founder and national coordinator of RootsAction.org, which is supporting Bernie Sanders. And here in New York, the artist, writer, and activist Molly Crabapple, who recently published a series of sketches from her time on the campaign trail with Bernie Sanders in Iowa and New Hampshire. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Arnie Arneson, let's begin with you. You were our first guest 24 years ago, right leading up to the New Hampshire primary at that time. Then it was, that was the re-election of President Clinton. But right now, you're in the thick of it. Why don't you describe what's happening in New Hampshire now? You're in Manchester, where President Trump held a rally of some 11,000 people last night. Right nearby, Bernie Sanders was in Durham at the University of New Hampshire, 7,500 people packed in. Talk about what's happening today in your state.
Well, obviously, what Donald Trump does is what he does so well. He's the performance artist in chief. And he knew to come right into the center of this election in order to make sure that he was the attention and that we were not. I think he was not successful, Amy. Let me just say something. I do think there's going to be a huge turnout today. And I think in some ways the reason why there needs to be even a bigger turnout is because of the disappointment in Iowa. And it's not just the chaos in Iowa. It's that they predicted there'd be a huge spike in youth turnout. There'd be a huge spike in turnout, bigger than even what happened with Barack Obama, and it didn't even come close. And I think to a large number of people, that is terrifying, not only the chaos, but the fact that there wasn't that level of enthusiasm, given the fact that now the opposition is Donald Trump. It's not whether there's a Barack Obama on the stage or someone that sort of floats your boat. It's that we really do have the tyrant in chief. And now more than ever, we need to show up. We need to exercise, unfortunately, in Iowa, not the franchise, but we need to participate. I think you're going to see a huge turnout here. I am praying that you see a huge turnout with young people. That has always been Bernie's calling card, is that he can expand the base. And I know every young person that I possibly know, and nobody is doing anything but supporting Bernie, which I think is really exciting. I am a little bit worried, though, and that is that there's a lot of anxiety and fear and anger going into this campaign and this election. People are still undecided this morning, Amy. They're undecided this morning. I have never seen the electorate so fluid. And here is my fear. My fear is that when you are undecided and when you are frightened, what you saw happen in Dixville Notch could happen today. And that is, we use a pencil in New Hampshire. That's our technology. But not only do you get to fill in little circles, you can write in names. And although Michael Bloomberg, who would be our benevolent despot leader, is not running in New Hampshire, let me remind everyone, not only is he buying ads in all the states, but the Super Tuesday states are what? Massachusetts and Vermont. What do we know about New Hampshire? A long, slender state. We are Massachusetts and Vermont. So all those ads have also been appearing here. And because people are so afraid and don't know where to go, he becomes the convenient punt. If I'm undecided, where do I go? That's not a solution. That's not democracy. You've ceded your voice. You've ceded your choice. And you say to the billionaire, not a problem. Take care of me.
That's not what democracy does. But I'm going to tell you right now, watch that. Because he was, I suspect that what happened in Dixville Notch was in part because he's so brilliant. All you have to do is sit down with five people and talk them through it. And what do you get? You get free media on top of his billions of dollars. So I am just warning people that this is easy, but it's not democratic. And therefore, you have to make a choice.
And Arnie, I wanted to ask you also about the fact that in this primary, independents and Republicans can vote as well, right? The impact that that might have on the final tally for all the candidates.
That's not correct. That's not correct. Here's the deal. We have the largest group of voters in New Hampshire are undeclareds or independents. They represent about 42% of the state. The rest of it is divided up almost equally between Republicans and Democrats. Months ago, weeks ago, you had to make a decision if you were in a party, if you were a Republican, or if you were a Democrat and wanted to become an undeclared, you had to decide then and change your status to undeclared. Because only undeclareds can pick up either a Republican ballot or a Democratic ballot. That means Republicans can't play in the Democratic primary unless months ago or weeks ago they changed their status to undeclared. So, but what that means is that whoever is running for president as a Democrat in New Hampshire has to court those undeclared voters. And I'd say that about probably a third of them are probably Republicans, and reliable Republicans, but they just choose not to associate. And then the rest of them are probably another third are probably Democrat, but it's that group in the center that I think a lot of the Democratic candidates are trying to court. So don't assume that what Donald Trump said, again, never trust the information coming out of Mr. Trump. Republicans cannot participate in a Democratic primary, only the undeclareds. But undeclareds are pivotal, everyone. They can significantly change the outcome.
And just to be clear, for people who are wondering what you mean by Dixville Notch, the community that votes at midnight, the first one in New Hampshire that only had five votes, almost didn't happen, right? Because a developer who didn't live there full time, they didn't think he was going to come back, and then there wouldn't have been a quorum. But then he came back, and that there were three write-in votes for Michael Bloomberg, one for Bernie Sanders, and one for Buttigieg.
No, it's an amazing story, but unfortunately, it also gives you a headline. And Bloomberg understands that because he can buy everything, including the most sophisticated consultants on the planet. And again, I'm telling you, people are still undecided. And Amy, let me just give you one example. One of the most thoughtful progressives I know in my state sent me an email, and he said, my heart is with Elizabeth and Bernie, but my head is saying maybe Pete or Amy. OK, so this is not about which side of the aisle, moderate or progressive, that he is even saying this should tell you something. And then let's go to the last debate. Never have I thought that debates mattered. But the last debate before the New Hampshire primary was probably the most pivotal debate I've ever seen in my life. One, ABC News gave them time to talk, which let me celebrate that. But what happened on that stage was that what you saw was that, you know, Biden never is a no-show. What you saw was Elizabeth Warren didn't perform as well as her expectations, and Amy Klobuchar knocked it out of the park, and I have proof of that. Amy only got four questions because she was low on the polls. Elizabeth got seven. Amy and Elizabeth had the same amount of time during that debate because Amy knew how to elbow herself in, how to answer the questions, and she showed a form of leadership that at least some people recognize. That's what happened to Elizabeth. Bernie did what he needed to do, no surprise. So I'm just telling you right now that that's part of the problem. What Amy did in that debate helped her when people are so unsettled about where to go. That you would look at a Warren and an Amy tells you about what people are looking at, and it's not about agenda, it's about Trump.
Norm Solomon, I wanted to ask you about the whole issue of the turnout. Obviously, Iowa was a disappointment in terms of what the expectations were, to the degree of enthusiasm that many of the organizers expected. What's your sense of how this particular vote will occur today, and especially the issue of turnout?
Well, what I saw yesterday, for instance, I've been to close to a dozen candidate events in the last week or so. Yesterday, I went to one that was for Biden in the biggest city in the state here in Manchester. And if Joe Biden hadn't been responsible for so many deaths of so many people in Iraq and elsewhere through supporting war, through supporting a neoliberal agenda, I would have almost felt sorry for him because the turnout was so scant and you had the feeling of a campaign falling apart for Joe Biden. I also was out in a small town, the Franklin Pierce University, elsewhere in the state. Bernie just rocked the house with a multicultural young audience of students, and it was powerful. And he was talking about climate, and he was talking about student debt, and you could feel the emergence of a new consciousness, if you will, among a new generation. And so there was this sort of transcendent feeling in the room. And then last night, I went to Exeter High School, public high school, where Pete Buttigieg spoke. And it was massive. The turnout was just incredibly large, especially for not a big urban area. I would guess 500, 600 cars in the parking lot, a couple thousand people there, and the enthusiasm was there. And so I think that speaks to the vectors of the turnout, where the bottom is falling out from the Biden campaign. And Bernie has a very strong base, and juiced up by corporate media that are not looking at the content of what Buttigieg is putting forward, there's a tremendous amount of hype that is catching on, at least in this state, in terms of the grassroots or some of the grassroots for Buttigieg. And I think it's very important for not only progressives but others, wherever you're coming from politically, to see that what Buttigieg is doing is swinging to the corporate center. He's done it all year. But in the last 3 days, he's emerged as a technocratic spokesperson for austerity. He's an austerity technocrat. And he's speaking for back to the future, obsession with deficits, cutting into the potential for anything like a Green New Deal. And that is part of the choice that's in front of the voters today.
I mean, I wanted to ask you, Norm, the media coverage nationally, and I don't know how much you're covering it because you're out on the streets in New Hampshire right now, is just astoundingly, the corporate media, I'm not talking about Fox, I'm talking about MSNBC and CNN, so anti-Bernie, it's just remarkable. Yesterday, I think one of the commentators used the term, let's talk about all the candidates. Bernie obviously has flatlined at number one. They say flatlined at number one. I was trying to think, how do you say number one in a negative way? Flatlined. So there's nothing to talk about. Amy Klobuchar, she has really risen in the polls at something like 4 to 7%. And then they talked about the Amy surge. And I'm just wondering, I mean, today on MSNBC in the morning, they're right there in Manchester. Trump had just spoken. And there was Bernie at a rally of 7,500 people. Of the six people in their little circle, none had been to Bernie Sanders event last night, which was not far away, but they'd been many different places. As John Heilman was talking about, you know, very significant 7,500 people at Bernie's rally last night, Mika Brzezinski said, yeah, but who knows if any of them are from here or something like that, if they're from here, you know, from New Hampshire. And this is a clip of MSNBC's Chuck Todd.
I want to bring up something that Jonathan Last put in the Bulwark today, and it was about how, and Ruth, we've all been on the receiving end of the Bernie online brigade, and here's what he says. He says, no other candidate...
If you're
like
a single man under the age of 35, you probably like to know what the ladies are looking for on an online dating site. A guy who had a few drinks and later got pulled over for buzz driving. See, that could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. And doesn't
an important ingredient for or a critical marker of success.
Wow. Okay, that's
I know everybody's freaking out about this, but you saw the MAGA rally that's preparing around here. There are people coming from three or four states on that. That's real, and you know, this is like Bernie.
That is a really depressing sentence that you just read.
Norman Solomon, if you could comment. That was Chuck Todd of MSNBC.
Yeah, I would boil it down to a five-year corporate media assault on Bernie Sanders. There was a notorious one-day period that FAIR, the Media Watch Group, documented on the eve of the pivotal Michigan primary in 2016, where the newspaper owned by the richest person in the world, Jeff Bezos, the Washington Post, published 16 negative articles about Bernie Sanders in 16 hours. And that pattern has continued. And what we've seen in recent weeks as Bernie's strength has risen is an escalation of the war on Bernie, not 100% war on Bernie, but the vast preponderance of coverage of Bernie from corporate media. And people need to remember that if you, for instance, don't trust Comcast, why would you trust a network that is owned by Comcast? These are class interests being worked out where the top strata of ownership and investors hires the CEO, hires the managing editors, hires the reporters. And so what we're seeing, and not to be rhetorical about it, but we really are seeing a class war underway. And Bernie Sanders is very clear about who he aligns with. He aligns with working people. He aligns with the elderly. He aligns with children who need neonatal care and nutrition 1-5. He's fighting for people who don't have power in the society and suffer from lack of power. And he's fighting against those who have too much power. And so the net effect is, it's not only the Democrat National Committee that Bernie is up against. I think even more significantly, the Bernie Sanders campaign, which now I think truly is a movement or a constellation of movements, the Bernie Sanders campaign is up against the oligarchy. And that oligarchy's biggest and strongest arm are the corporate media outlets.
We're going to break and come back to this discussion. We'll also be joined by Molly Crabapple. Arnie Arneson is joining us from New Hampshire, as is Norm Solomon of RootsAction.org. Stay with us.
Do you ever listen for the sounds that your hands make? Did you know that we could make sound? I don't know what the palace knows, but I don't run with sheep. Shepherd can't hurt me, my feet never slow. It is, it takes me, slip back to the mountains where nobody knows me.
I will make my home here, I will make my home here, I will make my home here.
All the fields are plenty to hold me, and try to keep us warm from the cold that burns me. My feet never slow, it is, it takes me, slip back to the mountains where
The Home by Portugal the Man. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The polls are open right now in New Hampshire, the nation's first primary. Some are asking why both New Hampshire and Iowa are the first primary and caucus, given that they are two of the whitest states in the country. But we're joined right now by Molly Crabapple, award-winning artist and writer. Her art is in the permanent collections of the Museum of Modern Art and the Library of Congress. Her recent piece in The Nation magazines headlined a Sanders campaign sketchbook. She's also illustrator and co-author with Marwan Hisham of Brothers of the Gun, a memoir of the Syrian war. During the break on the TV aspect of our show, we were playing some of your amazing illustrations. Molly, you've just returned from being out on the road with Bernie Sanders in both Iowa and New Hampshire. Talk about the illustrations. I mean, this is a perfect example of art and resistance that you have been drawing.
It's such an honor to be here, Amy and Juan. I was on the road with the Bernie Sanders campaign in Iowa a few months ago and then in New Hampshire a few weeks ago. I was doing these illustrations from life, packed into these, you know, high school gyms, these breweries full of working people, like with my sketchbook on my knees, trying to not just capture Bernie, but also capture the massive movement behind him. It's so exciting to be there. It's hard to explain, but when you're there and when Bernie or when AOC walks into the room, the energy in those rooms is like nothing that I have ever seen. And I have drawn a lot of political rallies for a lot of people. It's a super diverse group of people. It's everything from like maybe older people in wheelchairs sitting up front to young people involved with Sunrise Movement. And they are so excited and they have so much fight in them.
Can you respond to one particular moment? I think you were in New Hampshire when Mayor Pete Buttigieg was called out for his role in over-policing in the black community in South Bend. Your take and your sense of that moment in the rally?
Oh, my God. Well, Mayor Pete is someone who, during the last Democratic debate, defended the fact that he was locking up, putting black people in cages for marijuana possession by saying that he needed to do this to prevent gang slaughter. I can't think of a more racist, ridiculous statement in the world. It was like a reefer madness fantasy. So that's Mayor Pete for you.
Well, talking about police, let's go to the audio that has just resurfaced of controversial remarks made by former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg, who's now running for Democrat on the president on the Democratic line. Of course, I'm getting a little mixed up here because I'm in New York, and if he was a Republican mayor of New York. During a 2015 interview with the Aspen Institute, Bloomberg defended stop and frisk, saying, quote, 95% of murdered victims fit one MO. You can just take the description, Xerox it, and pass it out to all the cops.
95% of your murderers and murder victims fit one MO. You can just take the description, Xerox it, and pass it out to all the cops. They are male minorities, 15 to 25. That's true in New York, it's true in virtually every city.
Bloomberg went on to defend the over-policing of communities of color, saying, quote, the way you get the guns out of the kids' hands is to throw them up against the wall and frisk them. I mean, Mayor Bloomberg was sued for this. Hundreds of thousands, something like 750,000 black and brown young people were thrown up against the wall. Molly, can you talk about the significance of this? And I want to then ask that of Norm Stockwell. I want to ask that also of our guests in New Hampshire, Norm Solomon.
Mike Bloomberg is a billionaire Republican who purged the city of the working class, who sold it out to foreign oligarchs, and who terrorized black and Latino youth. He terrorized them. It is not innocent to stop and frisk people. This is putting people in cages where people were assaulted, where people were raped, where Khalif Browder was so tortured that he was driven to suicide. That's Mike Bloomberg's legacy in New York, and that is not someone who should be anywhere near the presidency.
Norman Solomon, how much is this being raised in New Hampshire, though Mike Bloomberg is not on the ballot? He is obviously a write-in candidate, as you described, swamping the country's airwaves with ads.
Well, Bloomberg is really, I think, a subtext. He's the oligarch in waiting to try to grab control of the White House. And a lot of facts just aren't getting out there. I mean, it is just a classic of, and it is a dystopian classic of, can the White House be bought? Just the onslaught of advertising, particularly on TV around the country, and he's rising in the polls. Has he hit the ceiling? We don't know. One of the bits of video that I think must be circulated to millions is on YouTube, and that is with Michael Bloomberg speaking at the 2004 Republican National Convention, vehemently expressing his support and endorsement for the reelection of George W. Bush. So how do you go from 2004 with that kind of speech to saying in 2020 you want to be the Democratic presidential nominee? Well, that would require tremendous amnesia among people who vote in Democratic primaries. It would require forgetting about or discounting the human lives that George W. Bush destroyed and that Bloomberg helped him destroy in Iraq, and for that matter, the war at home, the class war, the racism that George W. Bush embodied through his policy. So it comes down to, are we going to live in this fantasy world driven by a $55 billion man? Are we going to get real about humanity and what is at stake?
Yeah, I wanted to ask Molly, in terms of the work that you did of getting out Latino voters in Iowa, because most people identify Iowa as a largely white state, but there's a significant percentage of Latinos in many of the cities of Iowa as a result of people being recruited in to work in the meatpacking industry in the 90s and the early 2000s.
So me and David Galarza Santa and Jasmine Sanchez, two amazing working class Puerto Rican organizers, we've been organizing Latino phone banks where we have been getting people together who speak Spanish to call Latino voters. We did one in Iowa where we had like 30 people. And, you know, when you use the Bernie language Spanish dialer, because I've used the English dialer a lot, when you use the Spanish dialer, the level of Latinos who support Bernie is off the hook.
Wait. Explain what you mean by dialer.
Oh, sorry. So the Bernie Sanders campaign, like I think most of the campaigns, it has an interface for phone banking where you can, call in and connect with voters. And there's one in English, of course, but there's also a special one for Spanish-speaking voters, right? So what me and David and Jasmine did was we organized Latinos who speak Spanish to call other Latinos who speak Spanish in Iowa. And we did that right before the caucuses. And we saw the incredible, incredible support he was getting for Latinos. And this is a really important point I want to make. There has been this ridiculous lie that's been advanced by cable news pundits that people of color don't support Bernie. Bernie is the most popular candidate with Latinos in America. And there were six times as many Latinos who caucused for him in Iowa as there were to his rival, Biden.
Can you talk about this issue of these two whitest states? In every sense, a very profound point, and it's a tradition that's gone on for decades. Fascinatingly, the Boston Globe, which is right next door to New Hampshire, has just written an editorial saying this tradition must end. I mean, you've got two of the whitest states in the country. I mean, New Hampshire, it's like 93-95% white. It's not only determining the agenda of the candidates, you know, the issues that they're addressing, but it sets the tone since it's leading 2 years up to these two states. People are in campaign mode and going to Iowa and New Hampshire, you get this image of who a voter is everywhere on television, older white voter. And if you too are calling for, as Julian Castro, though he's now supporting Elizabeth Warren, who ran for president, a change in this order. I mean, it looks like it's not the fact that they're white that it might change. It's the fact that the Iowa catastrophe happened, the chaos, and that has provided the crack that has said, why Iowa first?
I think that the entire primary system, the way it's structured, is ridiculous. Like, call me simple-minded. I think there should be one day that every single state votes, and the person who wins the most states in the vote should get the vote. In fact, I think that probably if we didn't have this ridiculous electoral college system, then the primary system should also just be popular vote for the country. I don't know, one man, one vote, you know, call me nuts.
Arnie Arneson, what do you think about that? And is this a discussion that's going on in New Hampshire?
All right, well, let me just challenge what you just said. The problem with that is that guarantees a Michael Bloomberg. And the reason that is that the kind of money and name recognition you would need to win a primary on one day undermines what needs to happen. Look, I understand why Iowa and New Hampshire should probably not be first. I understand that we are one of the whitest states in the nation, one of the richest states in the nation, and the second oldest state in the nation. Oh, my God. If you're looking at a changing demographic, take this responsibility away from me and reflect the nation. The problem is that if you have a one-day primary on the same day, then what ultimately happens is that benefits name and money, and it doesn't develop the opportunity of relationships. I would love to see candidates be able to run in smaller states to create that relationship, but we have a couple of things going for us. Because of Citizens United, look at the flooding of money. All these things have benefited the wealthy. If you then have a 50-state primary, then you have guaranteed that they win. That's not what I want. I want the opportunity to evaluate a candidate and let smaller voices rise to the top. That will never happen on a 50-day situation. But I want to go back to a little bit of what we've been talking
about. We have 10 seconds.
First of all, let's talk about Joe Biden. A friend of mine watched Joe Biden the other day, and he said, you know what this reminded me? It reminded me of the movie The Sixth Sense. And that's really what's happening with the Joe Biden campaign. And let's talk about Mayor Pete. Mayor Pete talks in lofty terms about turning the page. Here's what no one in the media has asked him. What the hell is on that page? I mean, it's a nice line, but it gives you no content. That's how Mayor Pete is winning. He is winning because he's charming, but he's not giving us anything of substance. That's the difference between Bernie, and that's the difference between Mayor Pete. If you want something that will appeal to working people where they trust it and they know you will...
Arnie Arneson, we're going to have to leave it there.
Bernie does that.
Host of The Attitude on WNHN-FM in Concord, New Hampshire. Thanks so much to Norman Solomon and to Molly Crabapple. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Listener supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. Featuring local and independent artists.
Guys and dolls, you are at the Malt Shop with Daddy G here in WHFR. And we're going back to the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze,